Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, it's the first Wednesday of the month. That means it's time to take a look at our Wisconsin wildlife with wildlife expert Scott Craven. Great to have him here and certainly happy to have you listening in as well as we talk with him about all the things that are going on in the great outdoors here in Wisconsin. You may have a great experience to share or a question about something that you've seen or would like to see. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Scott Craven, welcome back.
Larry, it's great to be back, and it's just really nice to be able to get outside for a change after the brutal winter. Spring seems to finally be here in earnest.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, I do this little walk every morning, or jog, I guess you could call it, around the neighborhood, and the birds, what a symphony you have in the morning. Man, they're crying.
There's lots of stuff chirping going on. 2 days ago, the feeder's been pretty active. The goldfinches have really turned brilliant yellow now. So between the goldfinches and the house finches and a few other things, the feeder, that's been great. But my son was back over the weekend to do some turkey hunting, and he said, "What's that bird with the pink breast there on the feeder?" And it was like, male grosbeak. Mm-hmm. And we've had that pair of grosbeaks for 4 or 5 years now. I don't know that it's the same grosbeak. They all look the same. But just like clockwork, that pair of birds is back. They nest in the same place. And it was great to see the grosbeak back. There's lots of courtship activity going on now, you know, grouse drumming in the north and turkeys gobbling and strutting around. We're in the middle of the turkey season. Saw a first brood of Canada goose goslings that looked to be 4 or 5 days old the other day driving over toward Verona. There's probably a lot of those around now. And I think the next big thing to come back will be the hummingbirds and orioles. Maybe some people have gotten them. I haven't seen any yet.
I haven't gotten any. I've got my feeder up, my oriole feeder, but I haven't seen one yet.
I've got the grape jelly out there, and there was a catbird on it this morning. And then a Cooper's hawk came through the yard, and everybody disappeared, which is understandable. But the hummingbirds should be back shortly, and the rest of the insect-eating birds. And, you know, we're kind of entering the period where typically migratory bird day and all the bird festivals and field trips and all. So it's a great time to be interested in birds.
Oh, absolutely. And you've got the Horicon Bird Festival is one of the events coming up. I know lots.
Yep, the annual bird festival at Horicon is May 9 through 12. So coming up this weekend, there's all sorts of birding opportunities associated with that, including bus, bike, boat, and hike options. And there's even a first light tour at 6 o'clock, a night sounds tour in the evening. There's a HoriconMarshBirdClub.com website that has all those details. But it's a nice place. We've also got we got a message this morning that there are still some spots on the Saturday special birding blitz associated with the Wisconsin Birdathon from the Natural Resources Foundation. This trip is with former DNR staffer Mark Martin and Sue Foot Martin, and there are a couple of spots open. It'll be bird searching in the Goose Pond and Columbia County wetlands areas from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday the 10th. And it's a great trip for both. It's advertised as a great trip for both novice and experienced birders, and the fee includes a pretty nice donation to the Bird Protection Fund. So if you choose to participate, it's trip number 16. You can get to the registration on at Wisconsin, wisconservation.org. And hey, there's all sorts of stuff going on out there.
All sorts of great stuff going on. And I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. The number 800-642-1234. Grace has got something for us right now, so let's go there. Hi, Grace.
Hello, hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I've got a scarlet tanager right on my bird bath. It's the first one I've ever seen here. I have a block of 13 acres of woods and a block of about 40 acres of hardwoods outside of New Glarus. And also, I've got multiple male grosbeaks. We've had like at least three and maybe four. We've got at least one female hanging out. But I had already dialed and came out to the kitchen to see who was out here, and it's the first time I've ever seen a scarlet tanager here.
Well, that's pretty cool. If you had to list kind of on one hand the most spectacular colored birds to have around, tanager and cardinal would certainly get the red vote, and then oriole and bluebird and so forth. So they are pretty neat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and one of the things that I did have an oriole here yesterday, too.
Oh, good.
So that was really great. I've got a pair of robins nesting on the back porch. She has four eggs in there and started setting. One thing that was a little bit strange this year is we helped friends do their prairie burn. There were two or three turkeys that flew up, and one of them had nine eggs. So the eggs were partially cooked, and we wound up having them for dinner, and the guy whose place we burned had the rest of them for lunch the next day.
Oh, my goodness.
They were absolutely fantastic, and there's a hummingbird out here now, too. A hummingbird just came to check out the tulips.
Well, now, here's the other question. Do you have any morel mushrooms yet?
I was in the woods because we just healed in some butternut and white pine seedlings, and I looked around a couple of the trees and did not see any morels. Unfortunately, I won't have time to go hunting for them this afternoon because we make and sell soy candles, and we have the first market of the year down in Monroe today.
Ah, well, good for you.
I got the first picture of a morel emerging on Monday. So the thought from the photographer who pays careful attention was that we were still a few – this 80 degrees the next couple of days.
That'll do it.
This will be a weekend to be out. But
they'll pop this weekend if
the
you get that.
Turkey egg situation, a little unfortunate. It was kind of a late burn season because of the late spring, and I think it caught a number of turkey nests. But there's some – we don't want to talk too much about that. There's some legal issues involved in eating turkey eggs.
That's something to think about.
It's a protected, well.
Yeah. All right, Grace, thanks for calling. Larry and Marengo, go to you next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've got, if anybody wonders what the robins eat in the springtime, I have it on video that they will eat sumac seeds.
Mm-hmm.
I've had like 100 robins coming at a time. Same thing with the grosbeaks. I'll have up to 200 at a time in my sumacs. And, you know, people thought they were unsightly, but the sumacs keep away invasive species because they shade them out.
Mm-hmm.
And they're excellent bird food and deer feed.
And good fall color, too. It's sumac's got a lot going for it.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks, Larry. Thank you. Boy, it sounds like he's got a great menagerie there. Man, I love that.
Lots of birds.
Lots of birds. Rocky and Nishkoro, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just calling to let you know I was looking out my window this morning, and I seen an oriole looking back at me. So it's officially spring in Nishkoro.
Well, I better make sure the grape jelly is refilled tonight if they're starting to come in earnest.
Yeah, I've got the oranges. You know, I've got one of these with a half an orange on either mm-hmm. side and the grape jelly in the middle. And the grape jellies, the other birds eat that grape jelly. There's no doubt about that. Sparrows will even eat it.
Yeah, and the finches and the catbird I saw this morning. I guess I better get an orange out there. That's probably more visible than a little glass dish of jelly. And I found out it was interesting in the in Bird Tracks, which is the publication from the Wild Birds Unlimited store. They orioles, of course, will use a nectar feeder too, but I didn't realize that they prefer their nectar a little more diluted than the hummingbirds. You know, use a 4-to-1 mix for hummingbirds, and the thinking here is that orioles prefer 6-to-1. So let that be a lesson to you, Larry.
6-to-1, and and yet they like grape jelly, which
is almost pure sugar. So go figure.
Oh man, caller Mike from rural Columbia County has lowland near his house with lots of spring water. Thinks he's hearing frogs, but would they be in an ephemeral pond like that?
Ephemeral ponds are very important for amphibians of all kinds, including salamanders and some of the frogs, primarily because ephemeral ponds have one big advantage over permanent water, and there's usually no fish.
Yeah.
And fish are the enemy of amphibians reproducing. So, sure, ephemeral ponds are one of the first. They tend to be shallow. They warm up quickly. And now the peepers and chorus frogs and toads are all cranked up, and other frogs will be joining the chorus here. So I don't notice There are a few ponds around my place on the neighbor's property, and there have been some peepers and chorus frogs calling. It hasn't been all that warm. I'm anxious to see what happens in the next couple of days, because so far the chorus has been kind of muted, in which case I would think that given the frost and cold, it was a brutal winter,
yeah,
and that might have taken a toll on some of our frogs.
Yeah. I saw an article in the Wisconsin State Journal, and I think it was yesterday. It was about a town that has a street where the frogs go across, mm-hmm, and they're actually shutting down that street for a while. And I can't remember that. I wanted to really sort of highlight and give some credit to that little town, but I can't remember. Somebody will call, or maybe you know. You know it,
well, I saw the article, but I don't remember where the town was. It was an odd situation where the pond was on private land on one side of the road, and the frogs were trying to get to a wetland or on the other side of the road.
Yeah.
And the homeowner or the pond owner was quoted a couple times as well. It's the circle of life. If a few frogs, she described it as the popping of popcorn on the road,
goodness.
But that's a little unfortunate. But in any event, the town has stepped in, I guess, on behalf of other concerned citizens, and the frogs will get some protection.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Judith will look that up, and somebody will know the town. You can call in, maybe you know the town, or maybe you've got another question or maybe an experience to share about wildlife you have seen. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Peggy, caller Peggy, had 7 orioles and 7 male rose-breasted grosbeaks in Iowa County on Monday. Wow, John in Green Bay, all the way to Green Bay, said the Orioles arrived there yesterday. Tony in La Crosse would like to know how to keep house sparrows from kicking other birds out of their nests.
Well, that's a common problem. Yeah. Nest predation. There are a couple of ways to think about it. For example, people often think about this in the context of bluebird houses. Some of the designs for bluebird houses have an open top simulating an old rotten fence post, which bluebirds presumably used in days gone by. But in any event, the open top doesn't seem to discourage the bluebirds, but it does bother the sparrows. So there's some house designs that will help. On occasion, a block that extends the opening a little more,
mm-hmm,
will discourage the sparrows, and making sure that the opening size is keyed to the bird you're interested in. Some smaller opening sizes will also discourage sparrows. And then, of course, you can be persistent if you see a sparrow using a box. Take the box down, open it up, get rid of the sparrow nest, and then proceed to hope that you get what you're after, whether it's tree swallows or bluebirds or whatever else. So you can be a little there's some active management involved in sparrows, yeah, which can be very persistent.
And a Facebook question from Sam Samuel, who's seen several completely white birds, bigger than a heron, about the size of a sandhill crane, wondering what they are and maybe where they are migrating from. I'm in the Green Bay area. First thing that comes to mind is pelican, but, I mean, of course, that's not quite as big as...
Well, that's a tough one in terms of the information to go on, but
yeah,
bigger than a heron, but heron-like, that's the,
yeah,
key thing. Whether we're talking about some sort of the larger egrets, that's one possibility,
yeah,
but big white birds, pelican comes to mind.
Yeah.
I would think that Sam, had it been, say, a swan or something else, which are the biggest white birds,
yeah,
but swimming around, it'd be kind of a dead giveaway, so... I'm not sure what to say there, but those are the possibilities.
Yep, those are the possibilities. And we'll talk about some more possibilities with our guest, Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. We always love to hear from you when you have a question about wildlife. This is an important time of the year for turtles, by the way. I just kind of mentioned it in passing, but there's a lot of dangers out there for those turtles, as as they move around? What are they up to? And
well, as we creep up on June here and the peak turtle nesting period, these animals are kind of out of harm's way in wetlands and ponds and so forth most of the year. But the females in particular, once nesting season starts, make long distance moves overland to find a suitable nesting site, a cut bank or sand or somebody's garden or a roadside or whatever. And in the process of getting from point A to point B, you know, turtles are, they're not fleet of foot. They're pretty conspicuous. And I guess the two main problems, there's number one by far is highway mortality with turtles being hit by cars. And number two is sometimes well-meaning people, sometimes just curiosity. And there's kids say, hey, a turtle, let's grab it and we'll take it home. That kind of thing, I think, through education and, you know, talking about it in forums like this has diminished over time. So I think most folks are aware of the importance of turtles and the fact that picking them up like that is there's usually gravid females with eggs, and putting them in a box in the garage to look at or play with is lost nesting effort, and often the turtle perishes. So leave the turtles alone from that standpoint. And as far as the highway mortality, there are more and more signs going up. There's more and more sensitivity to this. And, you know, over the years that we've talked about this on the program and the years that I've watched turtles, you know, 20 years ago, you could stop for a turtle if it was safe to do it. And you were probably going to be the one who moved that turtle and saved it. For the last few years, it seems like if there's any amount of traffic at all, I can hardly get safely stopped and reach for the door handle when I see that somebody else has already stopped and grabbed the turtle and moved it across the road. So that, too, seems to be becoming more of the public psyche when it comes to turtles, and that's all a good thing. But busy road where it's not safe to stop or traffic speed makes it impossible, turtles have a tough go of it. So pay attention to those turtle crossing signs, and they're building underpasses and all sorts of other innovative ideas to try and get the turtles from where they are to where they want to go.
Dave in Partyville has something relating to that, I believe. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm hoping I wasn't a bad boy yesterday. I moved a turtle, but this turtle was only about an inch and a quarter long. I think it was a new baby.
Probably so. Was it brightly colored? Could you tell what it was? Or
I suspect it may have been a box.
Okay. Well, either way, one thing that happens in addition to the larger female turtles moving around to find a suitable nesting site, these young turtles are often emerging. And I think the perception, if you see a turtle about the size of a quarter or so, you think, oh, baby turtles, so the eggs are already hatching. Well, that's not actually the case. Young turtles that are out that people are finding or seeing now are actually last year's nesting effort. It's way too early for any eggs to be hatching this year.
That's what I was thinking.
So
I took it off the deck and found a safer spot.
Yep, that's fine. You were not a bad boy. That's a very good thing to do.
Okay.
And people will sometimes see them, depending on the weather conditions last fall, if it's hot and dry and the nests are in an area where the soil's hard-packed, the turtles, especially common species like painted turtles and whatnot, will overwinter in the nest and then emerge the following spring.
Okay.
So a flush of little turtles. Go ahead.
Got some bird questions here, too.
Okay, fire away.
I had a great blue heron that wintered over here. Is that standard procedure?
No, not standard. Most of the herons will clear out, but if you have an area where there's a spring or warm water discharge.
We have a spring here that he visits regular. I was wondering if perhaps he maybe hangs out over at the Columbia Power Plant, Lake Columbia there at 70 degrees.
Anything like that that either keeps the water abnormally warm but primarily open is the key. Most of these birds can take the winter weather as long as they can find food and water. So over the course of the season, we had lots of calls about robins hanging around, and here's a great blue heron, and people see bluebirds at odd times. There's always a few. Bird migration is kind of a normal distribution. There are a few that leave early, and then all of a sudden there's a great big push of migration, and there's a few that leave late. And way out on the tail of the distribution, there's a few that don't leave at all. And if they make it through, hey, they're right back where they want to be, and they didn't have to put up with the perils of a long flight somewhere.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call. As we were talking about things that migrate around and move around a little bit, there's a fascinating story about some unusual salamanders out at the former Badger ammunition plant. And we've got a piece on that. Let's listen to a Wisconsin Life piece from when those were first discovered. Let's give that a listen.
The Badger ammunition plant began in 1942 on the prairie between Bear Woods and Sauk City. Part of the plant were two huge reservoirs that served as the water towers, essentially, for the plant. The plant used millions of gallons of water daily. Staff at the ammunition plant was aware of these weird salamanders in the reservoir, you know, for decades anyway. I'm not sure how far back. We don't really know when the population started, if it started in 42 or if it started more recently. But they were sort of known about as a curiosity. The pictures of them are gorgeous, and it's what sold a lot of people on being concerned with this animal, because they are so beautiful. Kind of a yellowish or a lighter color with dark spots, wide mouth, wide tail fins, and these external gills, which come out to the side and are red feathery gill structures, very beautiful. They can grow to about maybe a foot long with the tail. They look like a large tadpole with legs. Neotenic, or the process of neoteny, refers to a species that maintains its larval characteristics when it becomes an adult. So neoteny in the tiger salamander refers to some individuals that never leave the water, never lose their gills, but still become mature reproductively. What would have happened is, we assume, is adults came to their normal breeding ponds sometime after these reservoirs were dug in 42, fell into the reservoir, and the reservoir has a vertical 7-inch lip all the way around it, which the salamanders can't navigate to get out. Did very few of the young ones survive by maintaining their gills, and they gave rise to a large population. A lot of this is really still a mystery. We wanted to get some divers down into the reservoir to see what the habitat was like, because it's a pretty unusual system where you've got 6 million gallons of water with a bunch of invertebrates and salamanders and nothing else. It's really pretty eerie and beautiful landscape down there. And it's, it'll all be gone before long, so we want to learn what we can from it. We're always trying to figure out how wildlife survives, what it needs. What we learn from one species can often be applied to another and often can be applied to ourselves. The importance of this population of salamanders is the story that it tells. Here you've got this big reservoir. Its only purpose is to help produce gunpowder. And what happens? There's these wonderful living system that develops in it, sort of under our nose and behind our back. And there's always lessons in something like that.
Well, that was a nice piece, wasn't it?
It was a very nice piece. That was Mike Mossman doing the recording, and he's a biologist with the DNR. I've known him for a long time. Great guy and very knowledgeable about this kind of thing. So when I heard it the first time, I said, "Boy, that's a very nice piece to describe this rather unique situation that, as Mike pointed out, we've known about for some time. I used to talk about those neotenic salamanders in my vertebrate ecology class 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So they've been there for quite a while, and now apparently, I don't know the details about the fate of the reservoirs, but of course, Badger Ordnance, which is now the Badger Prairie Park and open for public use, at least some of it, has been undergoing tremendous cleanup to get all those bunkers and manufacturing facilities out of there. The fate of the reservoirs, I'm not aware, they're sitting there. They've been there for 70-some years. Apparently, their fate is determined by the cleanup. But on the other hand, they contain this rather unique animal population and apparently some other interesting biological artifacts. So I know there are a couple. There's some conservation groups that have formed. There's a group of divers that are concerned about the fate of those reservoirs and the salamanders. I don't know where this is headed, but the notion that these neotenic salamanders are there has been known for a while. They're very interesting. They're unique, I guess, as far as Wisconsin's concerned. So where this is headed, I don't know, but it's an interesting thing for people to know about.
And just and by the way, Erica Janik produced that feature, and appreciate her efforts there as well. We had Joni from Racine phoned in about the we were talking about the Frog Town, the town that closed off a street so that the frogs could get across from the pond to where they needed to go, and that town is Waterford, Wisconsin. And Judith found that, put a link, TV news link up on Facebook. So it's up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show if you want to see a little TV shot of and story about the closing of a street for the frogs. Just go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. It's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool to think about that. It kind of goes along with the comments about people being more sensitive to turtles crossing the road and closing roads for frog migration and people forming bucket brigades of volunteers to get salamanders across the road when they're breeding and concern over saving this reservoir or potentially trying to save the reservoir where the odd salamanders are. It's a good thing that people are paying attention to some of the groups of animal life that were often forgotten for a long time.
And I should mention, before we get to Doug and Jefferson, there's quite a few Facebook photos up right now. Look at the Baltimore Oriole.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty bad. I haven't seen an Oriole yet, and people are sending in pictures of flocks of them. That deck is festooned with Orioles.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
And I had one measly grosbeak, and people are seeing dozens of them. So anyway, it is a time when things are happening very quickly. And I think the wind is supposed to shift today to a strong south wind. Whatever we haven't, flying squirrel, that's cool.
Yeah.
Whatever we haven't seen yet by way of bird life will probably be coming in with this strong south wind for the next few days. So
cool shot of a muskrat too, as well. And
what's with that owl?
That owl looks like, to me, it looks like Bill Volkert. it is Bill Volkert in there.
Yes. Okay.
He was yesterday. We had a little surprise birthday party for me, and there's a picture of some of the regular guests who were guests on the show who were at that party too. So that's another shot up there on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Oh man, Doug in Jefferson has a question or a comment. Hi, Doug. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I just wanted to mention something that I saw a couple of weeks ago. It was in the evening, about 7:30. I was driving down kind of back roads near Jefferson, and there's no traffic, and I was coming up on like a T intersection, and I saw a big barn owl, and he was over on the side of the road. It looked like he was kind of pecking away at a rabbit. I don't know if it was a roadkill or something that he caught. So I slowed down and stopped, and I was just looking at him at the intersection. He was about 30 feet away. He looked at me because I had the window down quite a bit. He could see me. And he started dancing around back and forth on his feet, kind of hopping up and down, and screeched at me. And then he put his wings out, I think, probably to show me how big he was, and screeched at me some more. And then he grabbed whatever it was he was eating and took off. I think he basically was telling me not to, that it was his supper, not mine.
I think that's exactly what he was trying to tell you, Doug, but it was a pretty neat thing to see.
It is. I haven't been that close to a barn owl in a while. I was only about 30 feet away.
Did you say barn or bard?
Barn.
Are you pretty sure of that? Because
I think it was. To me, it looked like a barn owl.
Okay. Big heart-shaped, light-colored face?
Not that light. It was more dark. Not real dark, but it was more like a kind of a medium brown, actually.
Okay. Well, the only reason I asked is barn owls, barn like in horse barn, cow barn, farm barn, are very, very unusual, as opposed to bard, which are very, very common. So Just asking, but we'll chalk that up to one of the great mysteries that turn up repeatedly on the show.
I just thought it was kind of neat to see because, you know, a lot of times you don't get, not often do I get that close to an owl of any kind. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was kind of neat because once he spotted me, he basically was showing me how big and tough he was and that I wasn't going to get his supper.
Can't find fault with that kind of behavior.
And I mentioned this one other time on the show, but I don't think with Scott here. I was walking back to my office on the campus and almost got to the building, and there's a red-tailed hawk mm-hmm. with a rabbit that it's taken right next to the sidewalk. I mean, 3 feet from the sidewalk. And everybody was stopping and taking photos, and I took some nice photos of it. I mean,
and he wouldn't give up that rabbit, would he?
No. It sat right there eating that rabbit and looked at me and went right back to eating. So there you go. Thanks again, Doug. Diane in Pewaukee, you are next. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Your last call just led into mine. I'm having trouble with hawks. And we don't have any birds because of it. We've had tons of birds forever, and they've just gone away, and this has gone on for 2 to 3 months. And I'm wondering, what can we do to deter the hawks from coming here? Mm-hmm. Is there anything?
Yeah, there are some things.
There are a few things. What do you know what they are to begin with?
No, I don't. The birds come up and every now and then won't come up to the feeder, just grab something and then dart away. And this has gone on. I've talked to my neighbors. They're having the same problem. And now I'm wondering if I should even put out Oreo and hummingbird feeders to attract the birds here with the hawk. I saw a hawk out in the tree, and I went running out on the deck and hollered at
Well,
pulling the feed is a...
The first thing you can do is mm-hmm. cease and desist on the feeding.
For a while.
And hopefully...
Take the feeder down altogether?
Yes. I know for an avid feeder, that's a difficult thing to do, but it's also difficult to see a hawk plucking your favorite cardinal on the deck railing, too. But I think that's one thing. But the first thing you need to do is get a good look at that hawk and either go to a bird book or go online and figure out whether it's Cooper's hawk or not. If it's a slender, long-tailed hawk in a medium size and it's Cooper's hawk, then they may be nesting in your yard or area, too. And you're going to have to kind of put up with a bird-free environment for a while until they've completed their nesting and moved on. The mindset to think about is that in the chain of command here, you're providing sunflower seeds and other types of seeds for songbirds and songbirds for the Cooper's hawks. But, you know, no predator's 100% effective at wiping out its prey, or it wouldn't survive either. So birds will survive, but seeing some of your birds taken for many people can be kind of some people, hey, that's cool. Other people think, whoa, that's pretty traumatic. So ceasing and desisting on the feeder will help, but find out if it's Cooper's hawk. If, on the other hand, have you seen more than one at a time?
No.
Okay. And you said something about her. I see on the screen here they were on the roof?
No, this one was right out in the tree, right off.
Okay, maybe we've got a different
sitting there,
the red
real
one.
Silent. And but no, I shouldn't even put out the hummingbird and the Oreo feeders, I suppose.
I would hold off on that for a while, yeah. Along with the seed feeders. And if there's anything you do, are you in a neighborhood or out in the country or
in a neighborhood?
Yeah, talk to the neighbors and see if anybody knows if they have a Cooper's hawk nest in a big tree on the property, so you know where they are. In the absence of a nest, they may move off if people stop feeding birds and concentrating them. That would be a good thing from your perspective. If they have a nest, as I say, you'll need to be a little cautious about the feeding for a while yet.
Yeah.
And you also need to be careful. Cooper's hawks can become quite defensive of their nest, And when they've got young, for kids riding a bike or people walking on the sidewalk, they can get dive bombed, and that can be pretty traumatic for the walker or biker. So there are a couple things to think about here. But first, make sure it is a Cooper's hawk, in which case everything we've set up to now holds true. If, on the other hand, it proves to be something else, you know, a red tail that's just sort of hanging around or whatever, then they're not going to be preying on birds anyway. The birds may be nervous about their presence, but that's not their primary prey. So then you can go back to your business and let the birds sort it out for themselves.
And thanks a lot for calling, Diane. Appreciate your call. And David in Sturgeon Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Two quick questions, one on behalf of my girlfriend and one on behalf of my cat. On behalf of my girlfriend, I am the one that has the apparently some sort of predatory bird took a rabbit on top of her roof, killed it, you know, had its way with it, and then there were chicken hawks getting up on top of the roof, and they liked being up there, so they're kind of sticking around. And it has a good vantage point. It's up on a bluff, so they're able to see down. It's where I'd want to be if I were a, you know,
mm-hmm. hawk.
You know, and the second question on behalf of my cat is, he wants to get into ornithology, so he's wondering what an amateur ornithologist can do to attract more birds to the yard to look at through the window, not to eat.
There we go.
You know, well, like what sort of like feeders would you get as someone who has no idea? Someone who was standing at the co-op yesterday wondering what the heck.
Well, this is a great question, Dave. So let's start with the feeder situation. You know, going to a place that has a huge array of feeders right now is mind-boggling. And I'll just tell you up front, you don't need a feeder that looks like a Victorian mansion. You don't need a feeder that's shaped like a Green Bay Packers helmet. The birds don't care about that. I use a couple of simple hopper-type platform feeders, and a couple of good-sized tube feeders that have, you know, like six or eight perches protruding through the tube. The larger, the better. It's perhaps a little more attractive and can service more birds, but the main issue with a large seed reservoir, either in the hopper or in the tube, is that you're not out there every day filling it with seed. So a good basic feeder, and even within, say, the tube feeders, you can go to a discount department store and probably find an all-plastic one for a few bucks, or you can go to a bird feeding store and get a really heavy-duty one with aluminum perches and so forth for quite a bit more. But the good quality feeder will last you for a very long time and will be at least somewhat squirrel-resistant. Squirrels are not your friends when it comes to bird feeders. No. So I do recommend a good quality feeder, either one or two tube types that will have large feeding ports to feed primarily black oil sunflower seeds, and maybe a shelf-type feeder with a covered seed port on it that you can fill with a good mix or sunflower seeds again. You can also put out a few suet blocks to attract some woodpeckers, and you probably don't need to worry too much about the specialty seeds like Niger thistle and that kind of thing just to get started. If you get into it in a big way, a thistle feeder, a hummingbird feeder with nectar, the kind of oriole feeders Larry and I have been talking about with a little glass receptacle to hold grape jelly and a couple of nails to stick an orange half on, you can create quite a feeding station if you're so inclined. So that's a good way to get started. Position them so that there's a little cover nearby for the birds to escape the aforementioned hawks we've been discussing, and where you and everybody else with a concern in this, with a dog in the fight, so to speak, can look out the window and see what's going on. Now, as far as the hawks perching on your roof, I assume they're primarily on the ridge line. Is that correct?
That's my assumption.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are things you can do to modify a roof that make them uncomfortable or unpleasant for birds perching. One of the ideas involves a commercial product. It's a a prickly metal strip with very sharp stainless steel spikes on it. There are several names. Nixolite is one of the trade names. There are other types. And you simply run a line of this along the ridgeline and tack it in place, and no bird will perch on that ridgeline with that installed. But it's very sharp and difficult to handle, and sometimes trash gets stuck on it. Before you do that, I'd recommend putting a little bracket on each end of the ridgeline and running two or three strands of 50 or 80-pound test monofilament fishing line tight from bracket to bracket, maybe 4 or 5 inches off the roof. That will also make it very difficult for the birds to perch there.
A lot easier to use.
And
too.
A lot easier to use and replace and so forth. So there are a couple modifications like that. And if you Google roof treatments and birds, you'll probably find a couple of other ideas. But what you need is some type of physical barrier to make it uncomfortable or inaccessible for the birds to actually perch there.
And back to the feeders for just a minute. I have a feeder that is squirrel-proof. It is one. I actually have two of them. I paid a princely sum,
princely sum.
Like $100 or so. But they actually, when the squirrel, it's sort of a weight-driven thing. So when the squirrel actually tries to stand on it, the squirrel's weight pulls the bottom part of the feeder down and covers the hole so that they can't get at the food.
Oh, I saw one of those at the store.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think it was about $15. Those are okay.
Oh. They do work, and they're entertaining.
Yeah.
In terms of trying to do battle with the squirrels can be one of the high points of a feeder's operation if you're so inclined.
Well, and my cat is very interested.
If you don't want to spend. If you don't want to spend a lot of money on this just to get started, you know, there are all sorts of designs for recycled feeders. You know, just making a quick feeder out of a 2-liter soda bottle, out of a 1/2-gallon milk container.
Yeah,
if you Google recycled bird feeders, I think you could create 4 or 5 feeders to hang out in an afternoon for nothing. And at least see how you like it, and then think about the $40, $50, $60 or $100 feeders if you really get into it.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. That's a good question that I think a lot of people are interested in the answers, your answers to that, Scott. Linda in Milwaukee, we'll get to you in just a minute. I want to remind you, though, that our guest today, wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Well, for our listeners up north, I want to mention I'm going to be in Washburn, Wisconsin, for a special meet and greet event on Thursday, May 15th. That's the night before our live Garden Talk broadcast. At Bayfield in Bloom. And I'll be there. Jennifer Dargan will be there, Assistant Director of the Ideas Network, and we'll be at the Washburn Cultural Center. And it's times from 6 to 7:30. I've been going to Bayfield and Bloom and going through Washburn for years. Thought it might be fun to have a little reception this time around. We'll have some great food from Coco's. We've got wines from Wallershine Winery and some door prizes as well. Going to be a lot of fun. $15, and you can find ticket information on our website at wpr.org/meetlarry. So wpr.org/meetlarry, and that's next week, Thursday, in Washburn, Wisconsin. So if you're in the area, I hope you will stop in and say hi, and we'll have a little something to drink and a little something to eat. And talk. And speaking of talking, Linda has something she wants to say from Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Oh, hi. We saw two birds this morning that we've never seen before. We live in the southwest edge of Milwaukee. It's a white, we looked in the bird book, white-collared seed eater. It's supposed to be a native of Mexico and Central America, but we've never seen them before. They're sort of like a robin, about the size of a robin. There are two of them there today.
And they were called, the name in the bird book was white-collared seed eater?
White-collared seed eater. They're black on the top, and the wings have two little white bars, and then their stomach is white, but there's a little red splotch underneath their beak, sort of in the front there, a little red splotch. That's the male, and we saw two males, I think. The female is more a gray kind of a thing, but this, there were two of them. We've never seen anything like that before.
So would you describe them as a very pretty bird?
Oh, yeah, they're pretty.
And mostly black and white, except for that rosy spot under the beak.
Yeah, it's a very small spot. You really can't see. There's almost like a little necklace of black also there, but mostly it's a white breast. And the beak is a thick, short beak. It's thick. Mm. And it's not, they say wingspan 8 inches, length 4.5 inches. That's what it says in the bird book.
If you have your bird book handy, would you do me a favor and look up a male rose-breasted grosbeak?
Ooh, how do I find that?
Well, I mean, what you're describing, you know, when it comes to identifying things in the wild, birds, mammals, snakes, whatever, we learned a long time ago in this program and throughout my career to never say anything was impossible.
Yeah.
Because lots of weird stuff turns up either on its own or with human intervention. So we've had roadrunners in Wisconsin. We've had prairie dogs that we've talked about on the show. We've had weird hummingbirds that get blown in with storms. So while anything is possible, we try to look for the most plausible explanation for some of these sightings first. And I don't believe, I'm not sure that I've ever, hang on a second. I see the
figure out where to find roseback.
That's the white-collared seed eater.
I see the white-collared seed eater here. It certainly does have a white band around it, and it does have a typical seed-eating bill, which is very much like a grosbeak bill. But I think I can see where there might be a. Well, I don't know what to say here. If it's a white-collared seed eater, you need to call the Milwaukee Audubon Society. And or try and get a picture of it. That would be a very rare bird, and a lot of people would like to see them. If, on the other hand, you look at rose-breasted grosbeak, which looks a lot like this and has the spot on the throat, then, as we've been talking about for the last hour or so, lots of people all of a sudden got their grosbeaks back just in the last 48 hours. So
You call rose-breasted, okay.
Rose-breasted grosbeak.
I can't seem to figure out which one it is, your 680.
But the male grosbeak is black and white, has the spot you're describing, is the right size, and has the thick beak, and is infinitely more likely than a Mexican bird driven this far
that
north.
The red on his breast, on these two that we saw, is a very small spot. It's not as big as the picture in the bird book here. It's a big red. It has a bigger red. But we used to see them when we lived in Warsaw.
Yeah.
But no, it didn't. It wasn't like quite like that.
Well, we just looked at very clear images of the white collared seed eater on the smartphone, and if you got a good look at it and that's what you think, then are they still there?
No. They were here at about 6:45, and
then they're gone. Yeah.
Well, if you see them again, certainly try and get a picture. And a rare bird like that will likely turn up on the Bird Watchers Network. So, watch for information from the Milwaukee Audubon Society. See if anything's posted. So, who knows? Could have been the white-collared seed eater.
Could have been. Thanks, Linda. Earl and Delavan, it's your turn. Hi, Earl.
Hey there, guys.
How's it going? What can we do for you?
Okay, my question is barn swallows. I have a large garage, and I have been battling barn swallows for the past 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried, you know, Scott talked about those, like, spike strip types of things. I sort of watched where they nested, and after they had their babies and left, over the winter I put in the spike strips and stuff, but they still keep coming back. And is there anything you can do to discourage them from coming in and out of the garage?
So the garage is open all the time?
No.
No.
No, no, no. I keep it closed as much as I can. That's the thing that's amazing to me is how they basically hover around the building. It's a large garage. It's about 3,500 square feet. And they actually will, like, be hovering around. They'll stop on the roof, and they'll wait for the door to open. And then they'll swoop in. And the same thing, when I close the door, if they're not by their nest, they'll come, like, I mean, it's amazing. They'll come down with the ground, and the door's maybe 2 feet above the ground before closing, and come, you know, flying out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the issue is they go in there and basically I have bird droppings all over the place all the time.
Right. It's a big nuisance. So all the nesting activity that's problematic is actually inside the garage.
Yeah. That's the sound of it.
Okay. Well, the notion of, well, you can try and retrofit some of the interior stuff. Is Earl still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. When they're in the garage, what are they nesting on? The tops of beams or the corners?
Well, it's really funny because I took, like, you know, tops of beams where I put the strips and stuff,
mm-hmm.
discouraged them there, and they're so persistent. They were literally, one built a nest, and I couldn't find it last year until it was after the babies came out. They built a nest on top of an electrical box. You know, like for a light.
Sure. Oh, they'll do that.
Okay. So is the garage is all open beam, so we're going to run out of time here for a second. We may have to come back on and say something. One option in a building where the beams are exposed but otherwise not used for storage is a sheet of plastic bird netting stapled to the undersurface of the beams. You can screen off the whole potential nesting area with that stuff. The other possibility, where the door is open or where the door is open a lot, get some truck loading door plastic, kind of like these hanging strips that mm-hmm. you can actually pass through. But as something goes through, the strips close behind mm-hmm. them. That will also eliminate their access.
Yeah.
So a couple things to think about.
And thanks very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today, and he's going to stay with us, be with us right up until 12:30. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. And we'll be back with Scott Craven right after this look at the news. So please stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, our wildlife specialist. Great to have him along. Thank you for listening in. Questions for him, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, you know, one of the things I don't think we've talked about yet, Scott, is the Coverts Project that you've been very active in for many a year now.
Yes, the program has been held since the early 1990s in Wisconsin. It's billed as a woodland wildlife management program for private landowners. Essentially, it's a four-day workshop. Some years we have a couple of them. Some years this year, only one. The Coverts term is an old English word describing a dense thicket that provides shelter for wildlife, and we think of it, say, as a covert to house mm-hmm. a rough grouse. Anyway, the upshot of this is it's an extension program with a lot of support from a number of organizations, initially almost all from the Rough Grouse Society, but now from a whole host of family foundations and other initiatives. And we bring in somewhere in the neighborhood of 24 landowners at a time, wooded landowners, on a Thursday evening, and it runs through Sunday noon. The workshop itself consists of an admixture of field trips, fire ring discussions, lectures, exchange of information among the participants. It's a really great time.
Yeah.
The goal of the project is to empower these woodland owners to go back and not only better manage their own properties, primarily with wildlife in mind, but more importantly, to reach out to friends, neighbors across the fence, people in their community, to spread the word of good forest stewardship. And, you know, we realized a long time ago with only a couple extension people, we can't reach every wooded landowner in the state. But we have some 500 or 600 Coverts cooperators, as they're called, trained now over the years. And these people have done some fantastic things.
Yeah.
In spreading the word and getting educational materials out that we simply couldn't. The program's coordinated by Jamie Knack, who's on your program here with David every once in a while. And if folks are interested, This year's session is August 21 to 24 up at the university's Kemp Station, which is a beautiful place in its own right, on Lake Tomahawk up in Woodruff. And one other important aspect of the program, it's free.
Yeah.
Anyway, there is an application process because we are looking for people with a willingness to reach out to others who own, you know, reasonably substantial acreage and have the right mindset to be people, essentially. So if that piques anybody's interest and they'd like an application for that upcoming workshop, they should email Jamie at jlnack at wisc.edu. Get an application, send it in. No promises, but we still have some openings, and it's a great time.
Oh, yeah. A great.
It's just a beautiful place, and they eat well, and they meet a lot of like-minded people, and it's pretty cool.
Great pal of mine, Kurt Westbrook, was lucky enough to be selected a few years back. He came back for that really excited and enthusiastic and has spread the word around to quite a few people. So you're right. It really helps. I think it really does help in terms of reaching more people through extension.
It does, and it's just been great for the resource. It's been great for woodland stewardship. Yep. It's just been a good program.
Mary in Lebanon, thanks for waiting, Mary. Hi.
Hi. Well, we, of course, get our usual grosbeaks and our parvovirals, and we have four males around, and they're eating a lot today, and our orioles have been out here. And the fun thing for me this morning was watching two male orioles sit in our lilac and talk to one another. They were actually looking at one another and chirping. But our big news was the rare sighting of a Harris sparrow, which we've never seen before.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, that is very cool.
Cool.
You're not going to see those every day.
Well,
no.
You know, there's a couple things. We had, I think it was Dave a while back from Sturgeon Bay who wanted to get into bird feeding. When people start watching birds or bird feeding, part of it's just the color and sound and all the neat activity that it attracts around the house. But the other element, once you get involved, is the rare species like a Harris sparrow or some of the other things people have called in about that really kind of added the excitement of the whole thing. Otherwise, oh, geez, more orioles. Well, they're cool. But all of a sudden you see something really rare, and that really revitalizes the interest in birds around the home.
Well, we do year-round feeding, and I have an oriole feeder and oranges out, and we have a hummingbird feeder, and I went and got my flowers for the hummingbird yesterday too. They arrived today too. So this was our first sighting of the hummingbirds, but the orioles and grosbeaks have been here a few days. So.
Well, Judy, thanks for the report. Really enjoyed hearing about, especially that Harris sparrow. You just don't see them very often. Thanks again. Judy and Racine, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the great program. When you were talking about the squirrel-proof bird feeder, it reminded me of something that happened in our backyard. One morning I was braiding my granddaughter's hair, and she looked out. She said, "Grandma, a mouse just went in that feeder." And I said, "Oh, honey, are you sure?" "Yeah, let's go look." And I said, "We don't have time. We've got to get to school." So as soon as she came in the door after school, she said, "Grandma, can we go see the mouse?" And I said, "Oh, honey, I don't think he'll still be there." So we took the feeder down, put it on the picnic table, opened it up, and there was the fattest little mouse you ever want to see. I think he ate himself so fat that he couldn't get out. So anyway.
Oh, it's a good story.
Looking at him with his big black eyes.
Yeah, white-footed mice and deer mice, the two of several native field rodents, are very pretty little things, outstanding climbers. And someone called earlier about problems with house sparrows in their various nest boxes. I've got problems with mice in the various nest boxes. And if I don't clean those out in the spring, I mean, they are just packed from floor to ceiling with plant fiber and shredded up cloth and paper and everything else. It's full of mice, useless for the birds. So watch out for those mice in your feeders or birdhouses.
You have mice problems in the in the fall. They're trying to get in your house and they get in the birdhouses.
It's awful out there, Larry. It's just we're overwhelmed with stuff.
Oh, man. Susan in Milwaukee. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. A couple of years ago, it was in August, I was walking along the downtown area. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I live in the downtown area. And I noticed something to the right of me, and I walked over to look. And it looked like 18 to 21 inches high, and it was a circle of feathers, so it looked like a drum was standing there. And I got up quite close, and this bird wasn't at all alarmed by me. He was too busy eating something down on the ground, and his head was totally on the ground, but he had made a circle of feathers so that it looked like a drum. Could you tell me if you have any idea what that bird was? The feathers were brown and gold.
I guess I'm having a little trouble visualizing what you saw. So the bird, was it a big bird, little bird?
Yeah, it was a big bird, probably 18 to 21 inches tall, maybe 2 feet tall. And it had spread its feathers around, so it just looked like a circle of feathers standing about that high.
Well, it sounds like a nest.
Wasn't a nest. It was because then later on it did fly away. But I've never seen anything like it since. And one of my uncles who lives up in Reedsville thought that it might have been a turkey vulture because of the size.
Well, but you know, right in a downtown area and on the ground.
Well, we see a lot of weird stuff around here. I saw a wood duck the other day that hit the windows at Watts Tea Shop and was just standing there completely confused, and then he finally flew away. But it was a wood duck.
But the bird that you saw with the circle of feathers, it wasn't any type of waterfowl like a goose or a duck or something like that?
Not that I could tell. And like I said, well, the feathers were brown and gold.
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, a lot of birds will use feathers, their own or what they gather up or have available or whatever else, and use those to line or work on making a nest platform, which would give you the circular shape and maybe the drum-like appearance. But
maybe
it's not uncommon that they would leave a nest. They may not have started to lay yet, or they usually leave the nest periodically to get something to eat. So
somebody called in and said, you know, maybe it was a raptor with its wings wrapped around a prey. You know?
Well,
that would give the circle of feathers.
And there are birds around the world that make various display bowers and things like that, but not something, even though there's lots of weird activity in that area of Milwaukee, as identified by the caller, that would be just too... too much to think about unless something escaped from the zoo. So I'm not sure what you saw there.
Sorry, Susan, but thank you for calling.
My guess is either the start of or something to do with a nesting effort. Unless, you know, unless it was since the feathers were all the same color. Another possibility is our Cooper's hawk or some other raptor that had killed a bird, and they usually pluck them.
Yeah,
and so there could have been a big, you know, area of feathers of one type around where the raptor had plucked a bird for dinner. So,
yeah, there's that. We got a photo from Dwayne on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. If you want to see an albino cardinal or a leucistic cardinal, maybe almost looks like a cardinal, doesn't it? I wish the head was tilted a little bit more to the left, but
yeah, it looks more like a J to me, actually. But
you think it's a J? You know, kind of does, doesn't it? Now that I look at it, could be a blue jay white blue jay.
Doesn't seem to have the shape of a cardinal, but
yeah, it could be a blue jay.
And it's got enough sooty coloration on it and a dark eye that it's probably leucistic rather than
albino,
but cool picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Romy in Sauk County, your turn. Hi, Romy.
Hey, guys, and you just said blue. Anyways, my question real quick is, what's the deal with these black-capped chickadees? Now, are they a migrating bird, or are they so elusive in the winter? They don't hibernate. I know that. because a buddy of mine, he thinks he knows it all about birds. He's got a feeder, and we got the same mom and dad coming back every spring like clockwork into his little birdhouse. And, yeah, they're the same. But come winter or when it starts getting cold, they, like, disappear. I don't know where they go or what they do or... Mm-hmm. And real quick question, the other one I didn't want to ask, but since you said Blue Jays, Ian said to me the other day that, yeah, them Blue Jays. Are Blue Jays also, my other question is real quick, are Blue Jays nest stealers? And I'll leave it at that.
All right.
Okay, well, first of all, the chickadees are around year-round and tend to travel in little family units. So they do nest around here. They're also regular feeder visitors, but they're kind of a tiny little puffball, and in a tough winter, they may give the appearance of disappearing for a while as they head into heavier cover or gather around where someone's got an active bird feeder. Romy didn't mention whether they were feeding or not. If they're not, I would have expected the chickadees to disappear for the winter and be back again for the nesting season. So I guess that takes care of that one. In terms of the jays, jays have a bad reputation for a lot of things, but given the opportunity, I'm not sure what he meant by nest stealers. They might occupy another bird's nest as a start of their own, but they're not nest parasites like a cowbird, but they might also snatch a nestling or an egg occasionally as a food item, too. They're pretty opportunistic in that regard. So a couple of different behaviors that are related to this idea of stealing. Hmm.
And Cindy in Douglas County, hello. What's on your mind?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share a sight that I saw. I saw a mother bear and four little cubs.
Oh.
Oh, well, I know that the bears have been out for a bit, but four cubs is a lot.
Yeah, and I couldn't take a picture because I was driving, but I wanted to share that with you.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Not unheard of, but it's a lot.
And that's Douglas County.
Yes.
In Douglas County.
Yes.
That is very cool.
We had seen a mother bear with four cubs a couple years ago. My son and grandson saw in a tree just down the road from me. And those cubs were older, but these were new baby cubs that I saw this year.
Cute little guys, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah.
But they grow up to be big bears, and then there's other issues to deal with. But anyway.
Yeah, then they can stay away.
Yeah. Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. That was a nice story. Bears reminded me of wolves for some reason. And
reminded me, too.
What's going on with wolf numbers?
Well, it was announced just a few days ago that this past winter, the winter of 13-14, wolf population estimate was down to around 650, which was down a couple hundred animals from nearly 850 the year before. It was roughly a 19% decline, and I think there's a couple factors that went into that. Of course, there was a wolf harvest again last fall and early winter, so a couple hundred wolves were taken out of the population. But that was all planned. That harvest was planned to reduce the population. And, of course, it was a tough winter, too, so there may be something of a factor there. But even at 650, that's still a population level that is over what some people call as the stated goal for a population of 350. There are a number of different groups supporting different levels of wolves, and of course it always gets back to the lengthy debate and personal preference over how many wolves is enough. But nevertheless, at 650, A, the hunting trapping season did apparently do what it was supposed to do, and that may be further fodder for continuing seasons to keep the wolf population down. The debate will continue in terms of how many we need, not only as a matter of preference of some individuals, but also as a matter of make sure we have a viable population. We don't want to see them go back on the endangered species list. But for those who were hoping to see a few less wolves on the landscape, that release supports the fact that that is the case.
That's the case. Andy in Eden has some advice for us. Hi, Andy.
Morning. Afternoon, rather. Yeah, with reference to the mice getting into the nest boxes, what I do is I take a piece of galvanized valley tin or aluminum, like a foot around, foot wide, and wrap it around the post so the mice can't get a hold of it.
Yeah.
And then orchard orioles, are they getting fairly common? I had four males at my feeders this morning.
There seems like there's been more reports of them in the past few years, but I just don't know very much about population status.
And then a quick story, if you don't mind, something Larry can probably relate to in his youth on the farm. Back 40 of my dad's farm, driving a tractor, spring tooth, whatever, straight ahead, a fence line. To the left, a woods. A flock of crows or a murder of crows, whatever, in each one. They'd stay there. One would come out, grab something from the ground, and try to get back to where it came from. In the meantime, that released everybody. They come in, body slam them in the air, get them to drop it. Then they'd all go back again, and then it'd start over. It was quite something to watch. It went on for hours. A broken off handle of a teacup.
Oh, and that's
okay,
what they were after. Oh, that's a great story. Huh. So they were just kind of fighting or having a good time over a broken tea handle, teacup handle. Very cool. Here's something that's kind of cool, too, Scott. A Facebook comment from Jean. My grandkids and I go out every spring on our annual reptile drives. We drive back roads and find all sorts of reptiles on the roads, from turtles to snakes, and we put them in our journals, write about them. Then we try to get them out of the way of traffic. The kids look forward to it, and it teaches them how important these species are and that they're beautiful. They're not icky.
Well, that's a pretty darn good story and a pretty darn good thing to do with the kids, and that's the kind of thing that you know, if they've been doing this for a long time, and she obviously keeps records, those records I think would be very interesting to the folks in the Wisconsin reptile and amphibian program area within the DNR, and it would also be the kind of thing that could be reported very handily on some of the websites like Wisconsin Nature Mapper that keep track of what people are seeing at certain times and places. And, boy, they could have a whole series of information logged in just short order.
Yeah, that's a really, really good idea. Let me think. Here's a Facebook question from Brian, live in the Milwaukee River in southeast Mequon. Brian, private lake, surrounded by a lot of homes. The last week have been the invasion of quite a flock of double-breasted cormorants, hundreds and hundreds circling the water near the shoreline. They come in the evening and make all sorts of neat noises well into the night. I've heard and then looked up and that the cormorant population in Wisconsin was being studied, and it's been a cormorant population is higher than some people would like.
Yes, cormorants have played to a mixed review, of course. Back 30 or 40 years ago, the population was decimated by environmental contamination and persecution, and then there was an active program to restore them. They were an endangered species as recently as, I think it was 1982, something like that, and telephone poles were put up with nest structures, and boy, the cormorants came back with a vengeance, and then all of a sudden, hey, wait a minute now, there's too many cormorants, there are fisheries depredations, they were blamed for problems with the yellow perch population in Green Bay and a whole host of other things. And now all of a sudden there's still some ongoing control around the country of cormorant populations, and they play to a mixed review, but they're just another interesting bird with its own set of behaviors. So
Judith found a new book about cormorants, and she's going to try and book that for the show. So we'll maybe have an author on to talk about cormorants.
There you go.
Kind of fun. Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being with us today. And I tell you what,
I'll be back in July. No June show.
Yeah, we'll be back. You'll be back in July, and we'll be doing some other things in June. We will also be doing some things tomorrow. Lots of good shows. Chad Spade and John Miner will be along to talk about home improvement. Fix up your house. In the meantime, thank you all for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.